Welcome to Thinking Out Loud's mini-series on Expo 67. I'm Monica Kin-Gagnon, host and co-curator of In Search of Expo 67, a new exhibition featuring artists who have been creatively reimagining different aspects of Expo 67. And without question, Expo 67 has left us with so much to work with. Two fascinating conversations about the Indians of Canada Pavilion today. I spoke with Heather Igluliorti. She is Assistant Professor of Aboriginal Art History at Concordia University, and she is Concordia University Research Chair in Indigenous Art History and Community Engagement. She is from the Nunatsiavut Territory of Labrador, and she introduced me to John Moses. He is a member of the Delaware and Upper Mohawk Bands, Six Nations of the Grand River Territory. He's a PhD candidate in cultural mediations at Carleton University and a policy analyst with the Aboriginal Affairs Directorate of the Department of Canadian Heritage. His father was Deputy Commissioner of the Indians of Canada Pavilion. As my two guests discuss, the Indians of Canada Pavilion was a pivotal starting point for Indigenous artists creating and controlling their own representations.
My name is Heather Igluliorti. I'm a professor at Concordia University. I teach Indigenous art history, and I'm also a university research chair in Indigenous art history and community engagement.
Thank you very much for coming in and talking to us about the Indians of Canada Pavilion at Expo 67. You teach the Indians of Canada Pavilion in your art history courses here at Concordia University.
I cover the pavilion in both my survey classes on contemporary Indigenous art and in my classes on museum studies. In fact, when I start contemporary Indigenous art classes, I begin with 1967 because that, to me, this exhibition, this the Indians of Canada Pavilion, I really think of it as the beginning of the precursor in many ways to a lot of what we see happening in Canadian Indigenous arts today.
Are there specific aspects, specific artists? Is it the pavilion as a whole and how it came about in the context of Expo 67? Can you tell us a little more?
Well, it's a lot of that, but I think for one of the foundational parts about it is that it's the first time in Canadian history that Indigenous peoples got to take control over how they were being represented on such a major national stage. And so it really represents a groundbreaking effort by First Nations peoples to be the curators of their own history and stories.
So the art historians, Ruth Phillips and Sherry Bryden, have characterized the pavilion as one that became very popular because of its dissonance and not because of its harmony. And then they go on to say that it's very much the character of the 1960s itself. Do you have a sense of any of that kind of more critical aspect of the Indians of Canada Pavilion that got brought to the public at Expo 67?
Well, I wasn't around in the 1960s, but I do believe that it is that, that is the character of the time, and what made it so compelling was that it was, you know, at first they didn't want it to have such a controversial message. They didn't want it to tell the history so plainly and, you know, as truthfully as it did. Sherry Bryden's essay calls it an arrow of truth.
The reason why people became intrigued, I mean, in a sense, you know, Expo 67 as a whole, there was so much ground and pavilions that a visitor might have to cover. But in some ways, the Indians of Canada Pavilion, I think, sparked additional interest in part because there was this kind of self-empowered critical voice of Aboriginal artists that had basically come to the fore with those extraordinary murals on the outside by Alex Janvier, by Norval Morisot, and then both a photographic exhibition and didactic panels that were speaking very critically about the residential school system, as well as interspersing more contemporary art inside. So I think, you know, as a whole, it had this kind of explosive and provocative type of presence for spectators in a context where, you know, at Expo 67, a lot of it was eye candy and, you know, was a kind of world fair experience.
Yeah, you know, I wonder if it speaks to The real hunger that Canadians must have had in the 1960s for the truth about Indigenous life in Canada. You know, it was largely a relationship between the state and Native peoples, and reserves were kind of out of sight, out of mind for, I think, a lot of the white settler Canadian population. They just didn't have that kind of contact with First Nations peoples. And so to have an opportunity to hear that story told in first person, even if it was critical of the Canadian state, I think that that is something that that the Canadian public really grabbed onto. They had something like 15,000 visitors to the Indians of Canada Pavilion, which really speaks to probably both the intense interest in Indigenous art in general, sort of writ large, it's particularly in the sort of late modern period, but also to that people were attracted by hearing this truth. You know, the government officials had wanted them to maybe water down the message a little bit, to not be so forthright when talking about the residential school's history. But as you say, like, that actually turned out to be one of the major selling features of it. I think that was helped along by the fact that they had young Indigenous people as tour guides that sort of walked people through the exhibition and answered questions and were there to provide their own personal perspective on all of the histories that are discussed in the exhibition.
Mm-hmm. We have two contemporary artists in the exhibition, Christabel Stewart and Dwayne Linkletter, that are going to be contributing works that take as their point of departure the Indians of Canada Pavilion. So we're just thrilled to have that kind of critical engagement. One of the challenges, I think, is that Expo 67 in general has very few archives and very few traces that are available. And so one really has to go on a detective hunt looking for bits and pieces and traces of information that appear in newspaper articles, a few photographs, go through Library and Archives Canada. And then, of course, individuals who carry some of the history, like John Moses, who I'm so grateful you've introduced me to, who has a personal archive of materials that he's inherited.
Some of the things that have been influential to me, but that I don't teach with because I don't have those materials, are I attended a conference at OCAD University in Toronto in
2011,
thank yes. you, where I heard both David Garneau speak about experiencing Expo 67 as a young person and also Alex Janvier talk about his experiences there. And so for me, there was an opportunity to look at other people's personal archives of that history and to reflect on it. I think that you're right that John Moses is someone who has really fascinating firsthand information about that. But there are people around, I think that there's still a lot of work to be done in understanding and really working through what the legacy of Expo 67 is.
So what do you think the legacy is? And what do you think that this 50-year kind of time period and now this opportunity in some ways to look at the Indians of Canada Pavilion from this vantage point, what do you think it has? What do you think it means to bring it into 2017 now?
Well, you know, I think that they were pathbreakers, you know, that all of the people that participated in the curatorial vision of that exhibition, they were really setting up what would become, and I'm sure they couldn't realize it at the time, but successive generations of Indigenous curatorial practice and museology that we now have. I think we credit the controversy of the Spirit Sings a lot with the advent of Indigenous curatorial practice, but it actually has an earlier history. It goes back to that 1967 exhibition. And so I think that you can't tell the story of how we get through organizations like SCANA and the Professional Native Artists Inc. and even the Aboriginal Curatorial Collective today. All of these organizations and groups have their, I think, have that root is in that really groundbreaking exhibition. I have looked at the ways that we have been displaying Inuit art for so long, which is basically the same kind of themes and motifs come up over and over again, particularly when we're talking about the era that that collection was made in, you know, sort of modern era, 1950s, 60s, 70s, and into the contemporary Inuit art era leading up to today. So sculptural practices, mostly in the 20th century. And what I did is I took the things that we think of as typical Inuit art themes, which is, you know, scenes out of camp life, Arctic animals, dancing bears, mothers and children, things that you see a lot in Inuit art. And I reframed it from an Inuit perspective to try and understand what is it that the artist is trying to convey to the viewer through this work? What is it that, what is the knowledge that the artist is putting into it, rather than what is it that in the South, Southern Canadians see reflected in the work? And this is not, you know, to me, it doesn't seem like a very groundbreaking idea, but it's something that hasn't really been done in Inuit exhibition practice before. And it speaks to, I think, the importance of having Indigenous people self-represent in curatorial practice, because it gives you an eye onto a way of thinking through and having access to knowledge and art from another culture. And I think this is also what Expo 67 was doing, was having that contemporary art on the outside of the building and having people have to challenge themselves to understand it from a perspective not their own. I think that is something that was established in that era and really changed the way that other Canadians could see Indigenous art, because they had always, up until that point, had it interpreted for them instead of shared that way.
Mm-hmm. And accustomed to seeing, within the context of world fairs too, Indigenous people represented through particular types of narratives. And here was a kind of contemporary, fresh perspective that was both expressed in contemporary art, but also through a critical examination of the residential school system. And that narrative was inside the Indians of Canada Pavilion.
Yeah, you know, what I think was really brilliant about that exhibition is it does that thing. It says, it demanded that people immediately put themselves inside, to understand it from the Indigenous perspective. The first exhibit of that, you know, even though we think about, oh, well, it talked about residential schools history and the reserve system and the past system, but the first part of that exhibition was about the land, and it was about Indigenous people's connection to the land and how that goes back for millennia, and says, you know, this is our land, and this is where we have, you know, countless generations of our ancestors on this place. And so by setting it up as a sort of a land-based exhibition in the first place, then it enables the viewer to, as you walk through, to really understand how that separation has led to it. And I think that helps people have a more holistic understanding of Indigenous life. I think that that was fairly probably one of the first times that Canadians knew about the residential school system. And yet, you know, in 2005 or 2010, when the TRC process was moving across Canada, we still have Canadians today who are not very familiar with the residential school system. And so I think that it was an opportunity for contemporary artists to see themselves in a different way and to imagine a different kind of a future for contemporary art in Canada. And we see it now, you know, we see it everywhere. When I teach about Expo 67, as I said, I'm not a leading researcher in this area. It's something that I think is really important as a foundational text, thinking about the pavilion itself as kind of a text for students to understand how we got to where we are today. And I think it's really important that way, because it was this kind of a critical moment. It was a rupture in history where things changed, because Indigenous people were asserting their sovereignty, their right to self-determination, and they were resisting the narrative that had been imposed upon them and instead presenting their own critical perspective. And so it's really important for me to talk to students about that and to have them understand that there is this 50-year history of resistance through Indigenous art, contemporary art, and critical cultural practice, and that museology can play an important role in reaching the general Canadian public, that we can't just sort of navel gaze and talk to ourselves around academia, but that exhibition practice is a way to draw all Canadians into a conversation around the very difficult histories that we share.
Sego Sunagawaga Swadis Moses Young Yat Skanyatse Ungwahoe Ganyatse Hodnoshoni Ginyangahe Geteno Lene Lenape. So all that to say is my name is John Moses. I'm a member of the Delaware and Upper Mohawk bands from the Six Nations of the Grand River Territory. I'm a PhD candidate in cultural mediations at Carleton and am currently employed as a policy analyst with the Aboriginal Affairs Directorate here at the Department of Canadian Heritage in Gatineau.
I've been researching Expo 67 for the last 10 years, and I have to say that the Indians of Canada Pavilion has been elusive in terms of archival traces. And it has been a challenging pavilion to find visual documentation of. Your father, Russell Moses, was the Deputy Commissioner of the Indians of Canada Pavilion.
And yes, that's correct. Russ passed away, unfortunately, back in May of 2013, so it's just coming up on 4 years now. But he was a residential school survivor of the Mohawk Institute in southern Ontario, and he was also a naval veteran of the Korean War, as well as an Air Force veteran of the Cold War. And he had left the military in 1965 to work with the Indian Affairs Branch, as it was at that time, a fairly small unit within the much larger Department of Citizenship and Immigration, and was soon brought on board for the purposes of helping develop the what would become the Indians of Canada Pavilion at Montreal's Expo 67.
One of the remarkable characteristics of the pavilion has been the kind of self-representation by Indigenous curators, by artists, and by writers in the pavilion. It's also been a pavilion that's been called dissonant as opposed to harmonious. Do you have any thoughts on, in terms of your own research, of the kind of characteristics of the pavilion?
Yes, by all means. Indeed, the pavilion, by its very nature and presence, was dissonant, if not non-compliant in some respects. The overall Expo 67 theme was Man and His World, and the theme of Canada's 1967 Centennial Year celebrations was, of course, 100 years of Confederation and Canadian national development, all of which had occurred at the expense of Indigenous peoples' inherent Aboriginal rights and negotiated treaty rights. Furthermore, it wasn't originally intended that there would be a separate standalone Indians of Canada Pavilion at Expo. Mm-hmm. Any Indigenous content would be suffused throughout the Canadian Pavilion proper, or perhaps some of the provincial or territorial pavilions. But Indigenous interventions by Indigenous activists of that era, including a number of leading artists and also progressive public servants like Russ, led to the inclusion of a separate pavilion, thus providing the space necessary for what was essentially an Indigenous Canada 100 counter-narrative, and that's what the pavilion was all about.
Do you have a sense of what your father's role was?
Well, initially, within the very early planning stages, he was brought on board as a public relations and press officer. But by the time everything was said and done, and by the time Expo itself opened up to the public on April the 28th of 1967, he was one of the two deputy commissioners of the pavilion overall. The commissioner general of the Indians of Canada Pavilion was Andrew DeLille from Kanawagi, the nearby Mohawk territory of Kanawagi. The other deputy commissioner general was Reg Kelly, a Haida from Haida Gwaii in the West Coast. And Russ, of course, himself was a Delaware band member from the Six Nations of the Grand River Territory near Brantford.
You've told me a remarkable anecdote, which is actually described in a newspaper article that you shared with me, which is of your father tending a corn plot near the Indians of Canada Pavilion on the Expo Islands. Can you tell me more about that?
Well, I think that was just one, very interesting vignette from that remarkable summer of 1967. It was an example of Russ asserting both his own sense of humor and, asserting Indigenous food sovereignty, although, back then they didn't, there wasn't any term for it back then. It was just something he went ahead and did. There was a small plot of land adjacent to the pavilion that wasn't being used for any other purpose, and he took it upon himself to plant some corn seed that he had gotten from Six Nations, and it took root quite quickly and started growing very well. And he was told at one point that he couldn't grow it there because there was an outside firm had the contract to do all the gardening and the landscaping across the entire Expo 67 site. But Russ, being Russ, just went ahead and did it, and nobody further challenged him on it. And so by the time everything was said and done, and by the time Expo closed in October of 1967, there was a nice crop of corn that he was able to provide as a souvenir of the pavilion to a number of the hostesses who worked there, including a couple of the other civil servants who had told him that he shouldn't be planting the corn at all. So it was just Russ's way of getting his digs in, I guess.
In addition to your work with the Department of Heritage, you're also writing a PhD thesis that's based on the Indians of Canada Pavilion. Can you tell us a little bit about your research?
Yeah, well, the working title of my PhD work is Indigenous Interventions, the Incorporation of Aboriginal Perspectives in Canadian Cultural Spaces from 1967 through 2017. So basically, my two temporal bookends are the appearance of the Indians of Canada Pavilion at Expo 67, and then whatever unfolds here as of July the 1st of 2017 relative to a number of different projects, for example, including the redevelopment of the Canadian History Hall at the Canadian Museum of History, Indigenous content that is being fused into the National Gallery of Canada's permanent Canadian collections and exhibition spaces, and then also some of the artist-led, essentially, you know, 150-plus Indigenous counter-narratives that are being led by a number of artists, including, for example, Christy Belcourt. The legacy of the pavilion, it was a game-changer. Its message was contentious at the time, and it remains cutting edge and slightly ahead of its time even now.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yes.
to think basically that Indigenous experts led by Indigenous artists of the era would dare lecture the citizens of the world about Indigenous and other issues in Canada in a space that they had, essentially successfully demanded to be provided by the Canadian state itself, that hasn't been replicated since. There's so much talk these days about indigenizing and decolonizing and unsettling the museum and gallery space. Well, I think the Indians of Canada Pavilion at Expo 67 was ground zero for all of that. And, you know, in many ways, I would argue that everything that we've done in the meantime and everything that we're doing right now is an attempt basically to retrace our steps back to that original moment of control. But the problem was the pavilion, like Expo itself, was ephemeral, lasting over that spring, summer, and fall of 1967. The morning after closing, much of the site began to be dismantled, and the attentions and energies of our leading Indigenous thinkers of that era and the artists, many of whom had been working on the pavilion, were soon diverted to confront other challenges to Aboriginal and treaty rights. We have to recall, by 1969, the Trudeau government of that era comes out with its white paper policy proposal to dismantle the Department of Indian Affairs and get rid of the Indian Act and really extinguish this notion of what today we recognize as being Aboriginal and treaty rights and getting rid of all of that. And so, from the space of 1967 until 1969, we go from the huge high of the potentials that are implied within the pavilion to having to divert our attentions to address all these challenges to Aboriginal and treaty rights that are explicit in the 1969 White Paper policy proposal. And so all of these issues around who gets to speak on whose behalf in the museum and gallery space relative to Indigenous perspectives, that didn't really emerge again until the late 80s, early 90s, in the aftermath of the Spirit Sings controversy and the CMA-AFN Joint Task Force report on museums and First Peoples. So it was something that it was huge at the time. It had an impact at the time, but it was ephemeral. And, frankly, there was no curatorial oversight. All the work that had gone into all those commissioned artworks, for example, the huge outdoor murals by, Alec Janvier, Norvel Morisseau, George Cloutesy, as far as I know, those remain missing and unaccounted for.
They were
dismantled with the fabric of the building. So
yeah, and we have a few photographs and the National Film Board documentary.
Yes, yeah.
That give us the traces of it on site.
Yeah, so if those artworks today, should they ever be recovered again, those are like the holy grail of the contemporary Indigenous art of Canada. They're like the Amber Room, where are they? Do they still exist? And is there any way to recover them?
Well, a lot of the films have also disappeared. I think there was so much creative work, and you know, including the pavilions, the contents inside them, multi-screen films that were impossible to document. There's so much that's lost from that period. John, I'm very grateful that Heather has put us together. Is there anything else that you'd like to just mention?
No, other than, you know, just really wishing a happy 50th anniversary to the pavilion itself. It opened up just over 50 years ago. I'm just looking at one of the advertising posters right now. And so Expo is itself, the entire Man and His World site, including the Indians of Canada Pavilion, was up and running from April the 28th until October the 27th of 1967. And that pavilion in particular, you know, still remains a real game changer. It represents a real, you know, paradigm shift. And I think it's, you know, many of the prototypes and models that provides today would be of inspiration to Indigenous curators and gallerists, and advocating for this notion now of a separate standalone National Indigenous Museum and Gallery in Canada, which is the topic that we're, you know, in hearing increasing conversation about in some quarters, notwithstanding all the fine work that's being done at places like the National Gallery and at places like, you know, the Canadian Museum of History. In many ways, this really still underlines the need for a separate standalone space, an Indigenous safe space within which Indigenous experts on Indigenous issues can provide direct Indigenous perspectives on important matters of the day without you know, any sort of third-party mediations or filters of any sort.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us, John.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks to John Moses and Heather Igluliorti. Next week, we return to our conversations with artists. I'll be talking with David K. Ross, creator of a drone-based reconstruction of the mini rail route at Expo 67.
This podcast was created and produced by the Thinking Out Loud team at Concordia University. It previews the upcoming exhibition at the Musée d'Art Contemporain de Montréal. Opening June 21st, In Search of Expo 67 will offer visitors new perspectives on some of the most innovative and experimental aspects of the Montreal World's Fair. The exhibition is made possible in part by funding from Concordia's Faculty of Fine Arts and its Office of the Vice President of Research and Graduate Studies. For more Thinking Out Loud, check out our website, concordia.ca/TOL.